Okay, so now let's officially start our seminar 34. My name is Wang Dazuo. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Miami. So today I'm chairing this seminar named Low-Cost High-Performance Building Simulation. Is that too good to be true? So it is sponsored by TC 4.7, which meets at 6 to 8:30 p.m. on Tuesday. So our first speaker is Nathaniel Jones. Nathaniel is a PhD candidate at MIT and is the developer of Accelerate, which is a GPU accelerated engine for Architecture 19 simulation. So let's welcome Nathaniel.
Well, when I first proposed this talk, I gave it this name, and I think that a couple people scratched their head and said, why should I speak to engineers about a couple of fairly theoretical laws of computer science? So I decided to rebrand, and instead of talking directly about those laws, I just say that they're about speed. So I'm going to talk about getting fast answers. And instead of talking about radiant simulation, which is something that perhaps not many people are doing, I just say that we're talking about complex problems here. And to emphasize that this is a talk that's not meant to really delve into the depths of those things, but just to say, what are we able to do right now? I would call this Fast Answers to Complex Problems for Dummies. So what I'm going to do in this presentation is show two examples of problems that, as we would generally approach them, would take a significant amount of time to do simulation of, and how we can make those faster using, in the case of the approach that I take, using graphics processors or GPUs. And hopefully through doing this, I'll give you some idea of what sort of speed up you can expect if you're able to find ways to change your workflow to use graphically accelerated methods. I'm going to start by motivating the problem with this picture. This is a building that I used to live next to, a library that has an architectural adaptation to reduce the amount of sunlight that comes in. It's got these fins that cover the windows. And of course, during the hours when they need the most to limit the amount of sunlight coming in, those fins do very little because, as you'll notice, there's a building across the street that's providing the shade instead. And in fact, it's often difficult to estimate what effect our shading devices are going to have on buildings. How much are they going to limit the solar heat gains in buildings? So here, for instance, is the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, the first LEED Platinum building, which has this complex Brise Soleil in front of it. And the simulation of that, well, this is a model that was used to emphasize how easy it is to do models in a certain energy simulation tool. And I would argue that I can't really see how the shading device in this model mirrors the one that was built in reality. Now, it may be that someone who had a very good knowledge of shading devices said that this shading device that's modeled here is the equivalent of what's there and has the same shading effect, but I don't know how to tell. Now, what this engine here is really doing is it's trying to solve this equation. Basically, what this says is that the solar heat gain, or the absorbed solar energy on any surface, is just a function of a material property of the surface, and then some amount of incident radiation, which has a direct component from the sun, and a diffuse component from the sky, and a reflected component from the ground and from other obstructions. What I focused on in this project was speeding up one part of this equation. That was the calculation of this term here. And what this really says is that it's a function of the sunlit area of a surface, the total area of the surface, and the incident angle from the sun. And what it turns out is that one term there, the sunlit area, is very difficult to calculate. What we would normally do would be to take the surface that we're interested in, say the surface that's colored in red here, and we would cut out the area that's illuminated by the sun, sort of like if you were to follow the lines of the shadows like you were cutting out a paper doll. And that's a very time-consuming process. What we decided to do instead was to use a graphical method. We would take a picture of the surface, and we would take a picture from the position of the sun. What you'll notice about that picture is that you can't see any shadow in it, which means that any part of the surface that you can see is part of its sunlit area. And so if we could just count the pixels that were part of that surface, we could tell you what the sunlit area was. And we could use this equation that says that it's just the number of pixels times the area of each pixel divided by the total area of the surface. And that gives us the same quantity that we were trying to solve earlier. And so we spent a while trying to figure out what a fast way to count pixels was. And then I remember one day, a grad student who I worked with came in early in the morning, came to my office around 9 a.m., and you know that something is happening kind of weird when a graduate student comes into your office at 9 a.m. And he said that he had found something that he thought would be helpful, because it turns out that if you're using a graphics card to do your drawing, the graphics card keeps track of how many pixels it's updated with each pass. You don't have to count them, you can just query it and it's stored in hardware. And that means that the calculation can be done extremely quickly. So here's what happened. The vertical axis here shows the amount of time it takes to do a simulation, and the horizontal axis shows the number of shading surfaces in the simulation. And that dotted line shows the amount of time it takes with the analytical approach, and the solid line shows our approach. And so, of course, keeping the solid line under the dotted line means that our approach is faster. And that's a logarithmic scale there, so to give you a better idea of what those times are, I'll just put something that we can identify with here. And you can see that by the time that we get to 10 to the 6th, we get to a million surfaces, we're only taking a few minutes with our method. And if I were to try to figure out how long it would take the analytical method to do that, it's much longer. So let's try that out. We used the New York Times building in Manhattan as a model to test this method on. The story that I'm told, and perhaps someone here is familiar with the story and can tell me whether or not it's true, is that there are 186,000 louver bars around the building, and that someone calculated that if you removed one row of bars from each floor, you would have had to have built it with a larger air handler on each floor that would have necessitated a more expensive union contract to install. So there's clearly a benefit to being able to come up with a correct value for the amount of solar radiation entering the building. Here's our model of the building. There are 1,300 surfaces in that model. And this model took 25 hours to run a full energy simulation of. And of that time, about 30 seconds were involved in doing the shading calculation for that model. That's a model without any shading surfaces modeled on it. So let's add the shading surfaces. Now there are 220,000 shading surfaces here because of all of those louvers that are involved. The energy simulation still takes 25 hours. At this point, the shading simulation is taking an additional 6 minutes on top of that. But we did something here that we thought was kind of smart. We simplified the model by modeling those shading surfaces as simple planes. And now you could ask, does that simple plane provide the correct amount of shading if you were to vary the angle of the sun? And I don't know, because like I said at the beginning, I'm a dummy. So let's do this the dummies approach. And we'll just model those bars as bars with round profiles. Actually, they're modeled as hexagons here, but it's an approximation. At this point, we have almost 1.2 million shading surfaces. This is in the region now where, going from our graph at the beginning, this would take a decade to run a full simulation using an analytical approach. But using the graphics approach, we're still taking 25 hours to do the energy simulation, and the shading simulation is now taking 3 minutes. And we figured, this is good, let's keep going. So we added Manhattan. We had a pretty low-resolution model of Manhattan. It's just another 150,000 surfaces, so now we're at a little bit over 1.3 million surfaces in the model. At this point, the energy simulation is still running in 25 hours, and the shading simulation is running in 35 minutes. Now, you could argue that in adding all of Manhattan here, we've added a lot of surfaces that don't participate in the calculation at all. And, of course, I could have tried to be smart about it and identify the buildings in the model that actually do shade the New York Times building and just cut out all of the other buildings from the model. But it's only taking an additional 2 minutes out of my more than a day simulation to run it with those buildings. So I could argue, I'm better off taking the dummies approach here and just modeling the entire thing, then trying to figure out what's really relevant and what's not. So what I've shown here is that we have three different models of the building at very different levels of detail. And because we can use a graphics approach to model them, they have nearly the same amount of runtime. But the question, obviously, here is, why does this work? And what I want to bring up now is Moore's Law, one of those computer science laws at the beginning that I said I wasn't going to talk about. I'm going to talk about it anyway. What this law says, and it's really an observation, is that the processing power of computers doubles approximately every 2 years. And really, it means that the number of transistors on a computer chip doubles approximately every 2 years. And we can see from this graph in blue that that's been roughly true for the last 45 years. And I'm also showing here the clock speed of computers in orange. And that's been progressing upward at approximately the same rate. Or at least it did. I cut off those values at about 2004 because something happened in 2004. We changed the way that we design our chips. And so if you look at clock speed since 2004, they really haven't changed very much. Well, we're still adding transistors, so we're clearly doing something with them. And what we're doing instead is we're adding more cores to our chips. So, since 2004, if you want to make your simulations run faster, you have to do it using parallelism. You have to add more computer threads that can run more parts of the simulation simultaneously. And the graphics processor that I used to do those calculations that I showed you a moment ago had 240 threads on it, 240 cores. That's a lot more than you have on your CPU, and that's why you can achieve that speed. But there's a limit to the speed up you can get. And that speed up, that limit is defined by Amdahl's law, which is not just an observation. It's actually a model of how parallelism works, which says that the amount of speed up that you can get is a function of the portion of your program which can be run in parallel and the number of cores that are available. So if only half of your program could be run in parallel, then the best speed up you could hope to achieve is a 2x speed up shown there in the blue line. On the other hand, if you could get 95% parallelism, you can get up to 20x speed up. And what we got in that last example that I showed was a 10,000x speed up, which was a function both of having a very parallelizable problem because we could run each thread on, or we could run each pixel simultaneously. So we have a lot of things that we can do at the same time. And also the fact that we'd switch to a different algorithm, an algorithm that didn't involve cutting out the surfaces, which was a very slow process to begin with. So let's look at another example now. This is a problem that has to do with indoor comfort, indoor environmental comfort, and specifically asking whether or not people are going to close their blinds and turn on their lights based on whether or not they experience glare in the space that they're in. So I'm showing two simulations here that depict a person's view in an office, their fisheye projection, so that it's more representative of an actual field of view. And I show them both in sort of true color and in a false color that gives you an idea of the luminance level that these simulations predict. One simulation takes much longer than the other, 49 minutes versus a minute and a half, and it's also much more accurate. It predicts more light coming into the space. The simulation on the bottom shows less light, but it's faster. But if you were to design using that faster simulation, you would come up with an incorrect answer. You might think that you needed to bring more light into the space, make a bigger window, and hence increase your chances of having solar overheating or glare. And so we were curious, how fast does the simulation need to be? So we observed an architect working for a period of about 3 hours and recorded everything that they did in their CAD model. And so on the horizontal axis there, we show the time that they were working in increments of 15 minutes. And on the vertical axis, the number of objects in their model that were touched by each action that they took. And there is one period there that's long enough that they could run a full simulation. That's the period when the architect took lunch. But there are plenty of times when you could run the fast simulation and get the wrong answer. So we decided, let's speed up this problem. And again, it's very obviously a graphical problem, so let's try to do it on a graphics processor. And we took this building as a case study. This is the Media Lab at MIT. I went into the top floor there and sort of mocked up an office. We took some measurements of the office, took pictures of it using a high dynamic range camera, and then modeled it, and also modeled a number of buildings around it that could reflect light into that space. And I'll show you a few of the results that we got. Here on one side is the high dynamic range photograph, and in the middle, the calculation that we did using a CPU, which took close to 5 hours, or 6 hours, sorry. And then on the right, you can see the GPU simulation, which was much faster. And I'll show it again on a sunny day, when you can see that it's much harder to see that checkerboard pattern on the monitor. So here's a case where we have glare going on. The timings are roughly the same. For those of you who are interested, our glare calculation is based on daylight glare probability, which just says that the glare that you see is a function of the brightness of the source, so we have the sun there in the corner, also its size in the field of view, and its position, so that objects that are bright and located toward the center of the field of view have a high potential to cause glare. Those that are located in areas where they would be shaded by parts of the face, like the brow or nose, have a lower potential to cause glare. The sun there happens to be somewhat shaded by the brow, but it's still a very bright source, and I can attest from having sat in that position that it does cause extensive glare. So we measured glare from photographs and also simulated it for 32 sky conditions, which I've shown here across the horizontal axis. And during those times, we had, you know, there was some discrepancy between the actual value that we measured and the simulated value, and that's to be expected when we're comparing model to reality. But what you can see is that the CPU and GPU simulations are very similar to each other, which is good. The way that they're not similar, though, is in the time that they take. Those CPU simulations were regularly taking 6 hours, and our GPU simulations took on the order of 15 minutes. So that's a 24-time speedup. Well, a 24-time speedup is good, but it's not the 10,000-time speedup that we had before. So what's happening here? Well, the problem is that this just isn't a simulation procedure that lends itself as well to parallelism. What we're doing is ray tracing here. So we have some rays that are easy to compute in parallel. If we look at the direct light that's coming directly to the sun bouncing off of a surface, we could calculate all of those at the same time. But we're also concerned with diffuse lighting here, and each of those paths that we might try to follow for diffuse light reflecting through the space is going to take a different amount of time to reach a source. And so that leads to some amount of lag between when we can start one ray and the next, and that takes up a lot of extra time. So what can we do to make this faster? We need to find a different algorithm, a different way to solve this problem that leads to more parallelism. What we decided to do was a progressive rendering approach. The idea here is that we can treat it as an animation, and in each frame of the animation, we will trace one more ray from each pixel. So now each of our threads is doing the same amount of work, and we can basically achieve a much faster simulation that way. And so I'm showing here our simulation results after one frame, and 10 frames, and 100, and 1,000, and so on. And as it goes on, you can see that the image becomes more and more clear, and it's easy for, you know, our eye to pick out what the glare sources are. But here's something interesting that we noticed about the simulation. When we graph the daylight glare probability for each of the times that we were looking at that space, we don't see a lot of change within the prediction as we add more frames to the simulation. Basically, the daylight glare probability is based on spatial averages, and so those come to a steady state much faster than the individual pixels. And so after about 10 frames, we have a pretty good estimate of what the actual glare in that space is going to be. And those 10 frames only take 10 to 20 seconds to render. So we've gone from a 6-hour simulation to a 15-minute simulation to a 20-second simulation, and that's a 1,000-time speedup. So I just want to summarize what I've covered now. I've shown you Moore's law and said that we can expect the number of transistors on a chip to increase, and therefore we can expect to see more cores available to us to use in the future. And I've shown you how, using that, we're able to take a fairly complicated model and treat it the same way we would a simple model, because the rendering approach that we're using to calculate the amount of sunlight entering that building isn't really affected by the number of surfaces. I've also shown you how Amdahl's law says that there's a limit to the amount of speed up that we can get based on the amount of parallelism that's achievable in the algorithm that we use. And we can pick new algorithms to achieve better speed up in order to make our simulations faster and make it easier to integrate them into the building design process as an iterative process. I'd like to thank you all for your attention to this presentation, and I'll take some questions now.
Hi, Christian Kohler, Lawrence Berkeley Lab. I know some of the people that have done some of the original renderings. I think they're probably going to cry when they see your speed up. I had a question about the number of cores. You mentioned 256, and maybe you can refresh my memory, but I think for graphics cards, 256 cores is actually not that outrageous, because if we think of computers, 4, 8, 16 cores is kind of, 32 is quite expensive. Can you tell us
The first simulations that I showed you were done quite a while ago, and from Moore's law we know that the number is increasing. So when those were done, it actually was kind of impressive to have those many cores on a GPU. It's not now, and in fact the last simulations that I showed you were done on 2800 cores on a GPU, which is more than 10 times what the first GPU that I had available to me had. And we're seeing even greater numbers now, and we expect it to continue to increase.
And in terms of hardware price, just ballparks, is this a few hundred dollars, is it a few thousand dollars, a few ten thousands of dollars?
So here I risk the commercialism clause, I think.
Just don't name any brand.
What I would say, if you are one of the people looking to buy one, is pay attention to the actual chip that is sold inside of the GPU that you buy, because what you will find is that a company will offer the same chip in a professional edition, which might run you several thousand dollars, and in a gamer's edition, which might run you a few hundred.
Yeah, thank you.
Neil Cruz, Big Ladder Software. So Nathaniel, there's a lot of computation resource, like in the cloud, that isn't equipped with GPU hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have other solutions where you can use the same algorithms on the CPU in those situations where you will still see some level of speed up?
So these solutions that I've shown depend on parallelism, and that generally isn't available on an individual CPU. The good news is that everyone has a graphics card on their own machine these days. Except there's one big company that's trying to integrate it in a certain way that some of the features that I've shown won't work. But if you've got a desktop, then you have a GPU, and you might be surprised by the capability that GPU has that you're not using. Although your children might not be surprised, because they're used to going onto the computer afterwards and playing their games, and so they see that speed up in the work that they do.
Okay.
Dave Shipley, ICF. You just mentioned games a couple of times in the last answers to the questions, and I've read an article recently about how many of the gaming companies mostly do the story and the essence of the game, but they don't actually do the algorithms anymore. They buy them canned. Mm-hmm. So all that rendering that happens in the 3D world that they create is something they just buy from a company that provides those algorithms to them. So are there any resources that you could draw on from the companies that provide infrastructure to the gaming industry, mm-hmm. that you could also use, right, for these kinds of applications?
So that is true to some extent, and I would say I also know of gaming companies that do design their own algorithms. But the reason that both of those are able to work is that the companies that produce the chips are also producing APIs. So you can access all the functions of the chip they're using through those APIs. Some of them are open APIs that are developed by consortiums that are independent of any of the manufacturers. Other APIs are limited to a single manufacturer.